Thank you very much, Ryan Burrow. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, well, we've got Ryan close to us. I want to talk to you a little bit about this Sam's Club story. You know, you and I were kicking it around in the newsroom a while ago. I've been out for an hour or so. What's the latest? Do we know what's up?
We still don't have an official number of stores that have closed, but based on the media reports we're seeing across the country, as well as here in Chicago from what we've gathered, this is a considerable amount of stores. I mean, dozens from Memphis to Ohio to Texas to the East Coast. We're seeing it everywhere right now. People showing up to Sam's Club stores and realizing they're not open and probably will never open.
Now, I know you sent a memo out, so I don't know what's reportable and what's not, but have we confirmed stores in Chicago area?
We reached out to one of the stores that's open in Vernon Hills, and one of the employees told me that she was aware of Wheeling, Romeoville, Naperville, and Streamwood being closed, and we've got some people chiming in on Facebook, which we very much appreciate. Thank you very much to stores that they see that have closed. We will work to verify that. Not that people are lying, but we just want to make sure end that we can confirm that. And maybe we'll get a bit of better picture as to if these are 50% of the stores, 75% of the stores. We just don't know.
All right. Ryan Burrow in the newsroom watching that. And keep us posted, will you, bud?
Will do.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. On a phone line now is Bala Shike. He is a writer for RentCafe.com. And I sort of look at the renting picture here in Chicago and around the country. Balash, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hi, Steve. I'm so excited to be on your show. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. It seems as if more and more of us are renting. I know you guys did a big study about holiday spending, who spent what where, and how that impacts their ability to pay the rent. But give me an overall picture in the U.S. about the rent situation. Where is it most affordable? Where is it least affordable?
Well, it's obviously the least affordable based on incomes and rents in the biggest cities, in the biggest job market, Steve. Because although these cities offer highly competitive incomes and really the best jobs there are, arguably,
right?
The rents are actually quite high too, because landlords tend to know this information too, if you know what I mean. And even if you earn six figures in some cities, that doesn't mean you can easily afford your rent.
Here in Chicago, there soon will be, if there's not now, a glut of apartments, especially in the downtown area. They just keep building them. They're converting condos to apartments more and more. Do you see that around the rest of the country, or is Chicago kind of unique?
Don't really have any reliable data in front of me right now, but as far as I know, renting is gaining popularity, at least in the past 10 years or so it has been. And actually, home ownership has been declining in popularity at the same time. About in the past 2 years, the situation is starting to turn, but lifestyle renting is still huge, and I believe Chicago is not unique at all in this regard.
You know, and I know that we're going to talk a little bit later about millennials and how they're maybe now moving toward buying homes, but they were big apartment users as well. I would imagine they make up a big part of the business around the country.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. As I said, lifestyle renting is huge, and a huge part of that is taken in by millennials, actually.
All right. So do you see this as a long-term thing? I mean, is renting going to be continually growing across the country, or is this still sort of a reaction to the housing crisis from 10 years ago and one that will settle down?
I'm not sure, Steve, but I believe... I believe renting will still be on the increase for a while at least. But as you said, we still do feel the effects of the downturn in the late 2000s. So I'm not sure if I can say if it's still a direct reaction to it,
right?
But the aftershocks are still to be felt, definitely.
Balash CK, writer for Rent Cafe. Thanks very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me on your show, Steve.
It's 12:22. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Did you see that there was a power outage at the big consumer electronics show yesterday? The power went out for 2 hours in Las Vegas. We'll talk to Ian Schur. He's a senior editor for CNET about what's what there. But right now, let's talk a little retirement. Our regular conversations with Bill Geiger are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Bill Geiger, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Good to be here, sir. How are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. I come into work every day. I sign in. I check my email, and then I look at what my 401k has done the day before.
That's a bad sign.
It just keeps going up.
That's a day. That means we're close.
That is kind of what it means, doesn't it? Explain that for me.
Well, when you're checking your 401k balance every day, that means it's going up really, really fast. And things don't go up fast forever.
Yeah.
And they can come down even faster than they went up. Let me tell you a phone call I got yesterday. A gentleman, 60 years old, he's getting ready to retire in a few years. He called me up. He says, Bill, he goes, I have more money than I've ever had in my entire life. He goes, part of it is my wife and our age, and we've been saving. He said, but the other thing is this market is going straight up. He goes, I'm scared to death. And that may sound like a paradox, but right. It's not. He's going to retire in a few years. And if he has a big loss at this stage of his life, everything that he's looking at in his account statement, everything he's thinking about how he's going to live in retirement, everything about the bills that he's going to be able to pay is going to change.
And even if there is a correction coming that doesn't, you know, erase all of the gains that we've seen, you've still got assets right now that you're going to lose once the correction hits.
Yeah, you could lose 20%, 30%. And who's to say there's not another 2008 right around the corner? You got a $1 million portfolio. And that turns into a $500,000 portfolio, Steve. Your whole future is going to be different.
Okay, and that's what you're about, right? You're about protecting what people have saved and to prepare them for retirement.
We focus on folks in their late 50s to early 60s, help them transition to a portfolio that they can protect what they have. And this is the big deal the guy was talking to me about yesterday. He wants to take part of his portfolio and start creating an income, dependable, sustainable income for his retirement.
It takes a little courage, isn't the right? Maybe strength is the right word to get out, right? If you see things keep going up, it's kind of tempting to stay in, but maybe the smarter move is to take some out.
Listen, the most important thing in retirement is having dependable, sustainable income. We're going to take part of this gentleman's portfolio, and when he's ready to retire, he's going to have $6,000 a month coming in for the rest of his life. Now, if you've got $6,000 a month coming in, plus your Social Security, your wife's Social Security, you're in six figures. You can relax. You can have money in the market at risk and know if something bad happens, you're not going to lose it.
Right.
You're not going to lose your lifestyle.
All right. So someone comes to Geiger Wealth Management, sit down with you. What is it that happens? What's the first
thing? First thing we want to do is we want to understand how much risk is in their portfolio right now. I mean, risk on the way up is just a concept, right?
Right.
When it goes down, risk becomes a four-letter word.
It's a little riskier, Bill, when it comes down.
That's right. It's a little more risky. First thing we want to understand is how much risk they have. And we also want to understand if there's anything in their portfolio that's going to create that dependable, sustainable income they're going to need to pay their bills for the rest of their life.
Do you think that most of us have when you say that, you know, I host a business show. I'm supposed to be a little more on top of this. I couldn't tell you exactly where I am on the risk scale. I mean, do you think most people know where they are?
No.
Right.
Most people have an idea where they are. As a matter of fact, I have people come in and we do an analysis on our portfolio that shows the next big downturn, like 2008, they're going to lose over 40% of their portfolio.
Right.
And they have told their current advisor, Steve, we don't want any big losses at this stage of their life. We don't want to take any big risk. And yet that's where they're at. So most people, respectfully, really don't have a clue how much risk they have.
I would imagine, too, a lot of people had the right risk for their situation, and then they let it sit there, and they're not in that situation anymore.
Well, yeah, they're not 30 anymore. And Steve, I know you're going to talk about this in a moment. We're going to help some folks out today. First five callers with $500,000 or more in their portfolio, we're going to go through an analysis for them. I know you're going to talk about this in just a moment.
All right, Bill Geiger, nice to see you again. We'll see you in a week or so, a couple weeks.
Good to see you, sir.
Thanks very much, Ryan Burroughs. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, let's go to the desert, to the arid, dry desert, Las Vegas, where it never rains, where the dust storms will overcome you on the Strip. That is where CNET's senior editor, Ian Schur, is joining us from a phone line. Ian, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. It's a little rainy here, not like in Las Vegas where it never rains.
Well, not anymore, but it was. They had the first rain in 180 days here on Monday and Tuesday. And wow, I mean, I've lived in places that can't handle weather. Famously, Washington, D.C. can barely handle like a quarter inch of snow. But this was unbelievable. It was light rain, and I think I can say that with expertise on what rain is. And a couple of the hotels, actually, their garages flooded, which is unbelievable. There was puddling in the streets. And then a transformer blew, and they lost power at the largest electronic show in the world.
There's just some beauty in it.
2 hours.
There's some beautiful irony there, isn't it, that the electronic show?
Unbelievable, yes.
And they're blaming the weather, right? They said, but they said it was condensation. Now, here when we have power outages, it's wind or lightning or something like that. They said condensation was the culprit.
Yeah, what the problem is that what I've learned in the last couple of days is that because this place is a desert and they almost never deal with rain, they don't understand how to make sure their roofs are not leaking and stuff like that. So there was actually throughout the rains on Tuesday, there were like little buckets everywhere to catch rain coming through the roofs. I'm not kidding. And so, like, part of it is just simply this place is not built with that in mind very well. And so, yeah, they just, you know, the weather ended up coming together and creating a confluence of things that blew a transformer for 2 hours.
All right, so if you are doing advertising for Samsung, though, I think you've already got your next commercial round set, right? Because while all of these techies were in the dark, Samsung was one of the only companies, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think one of the only companies that had its own backup power system so they never lost power.
Yes, they did pretty well. You know, there was a lot of interesting stuff, but there were other people who, like, they have charging stations all around the show because, you know, it's the biggest consumer electronics show, 180,000 people here, so they have little charging stations for your phones. And, of course, the charging stations are controlled by computers that were turned off, so there were a bunch of people who couldn't get their phones all of a sudden.
Because power stations are, explain that, right? That's behind a combination?
It's like recharging stations, right? So you open a drawer, you plug in your phone, you lock the drawer, and they give you a code to unlock it when you want to come back.
Okay.
And in the meantime, it's charging your phone, and you can walk around. You don't have to worry about what's happening to it. But you have to unlock it, and they couldn't. My favorite thing was that there was a lot of snark, of course. We're tech people.
Right.
And so Intel, the chip maker, one of the largest in the world, put out a tweet showing everything, you know, dark area and all that, and it said, introducing blackout, trademarked, the biggest thing to hit CES. And I thought, wow, you guys at least found a way to have some fun with it.
You know, a lot of us are kind of afraid of a lot these days. Was there any concern or worry when this happened at this big show?
Yeah, we've had thefts in the past, and it's unfortunate. And so they actually, you know, the security guards, we have amped up security this year because you may remember a couple of months ago there was a terrible incident in Vegas.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, they actually upped the amount of security here by quite a lot. You know, it was very visible, the number of barricades and how they were controlling crowds. And look, I totally get it, and it makes a lot of sense. When the power out happened, they actually kicked a lot of people out and didn't let them back in until it came on, which makes sense. And you need to be safe, make sure nothing's lost. So that was all reasonable. But of course, again, you know, you suddenly had all these nerds sitting on the green, you know, eating their lunch and being hit by the sun. It was kind of funny.
So next year at the Consumer Electronics Show, there will be an exhibit by a water sealant company. That's what you're telling me.
You know what? I tell you, I think that there is a lot of business that's going to be coming in for roofers in the next couple of weeks.
All right. You mentioned the violence and the shooting in Las Vegas, and that reminds me of a story that you guys have up at CNET.com about this company. I think it's Yevo Labs, where they're taking guns and turning them into headphones or headphone chargers, or what? Explain that for me.
It's really fascinating. I've seen a lot of stuff at the show. I've been coming here for almost a decade, and I have never seen anything like it. So what it is it's a headphone company, right? Pretty boring so far. They make Bluetooth headphones that compete with, like, Apple's headphones. But the case that they made is made out of recycled guns. They actually go to places like Honduras and they conflict zones. They pay the militia to buy the guns off of them and then melt them down and turn them into usable metal that can be used for anything. So they're being used to create art, and in this case, they're being used to make headphones. The program is called Humanium, and it's out of Sweden. And so this company made the headphones. Wow. It's really a fascinating thing because it's a statement piece, right? It's not about technology here. This is about someone trying to make a political statement, and just touching them and holding them, it felt very visceral.
Okay,
right?
So
it's something I haven't felt before.
I didn't quite understand that. So when I read it, so the headphones are part of a larger effort where this Humanium, I think you called it, buys guns from militias and then takes that material, and it's recycled in. Or used in several products. The headphones just happen to be the tech product that we're seeing at CES.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. And it's really, we have a story on CNET about it. It's really just, it was very emotional. And especially, again, I mean, considering what happened in Vegas a couple months ago, it was really interesting to have that conversation. And also, it's worth noting that a number of tech companies are starting to try and bring, Apple talks a lot about recycling the iPhone, but there are actually tech companies out there like Dell who are diverting plastic that would go into the ocean, and they're trying to use it in their packaging.
And it's
and
saving,
so
it's actually,
but going into that.
Well, and Dell is doing that, and they found it's actually saving them money.
Yes, that's the most amazing part. They're 25% of the tray in their packaging is made out of ocean plastics, and they actually found that it reduced the overall cost of making it. So now they're going to spread it across their entire product line, which is amazing.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so we have just a couple of minutes left, and I want to save a minute to talk about Apple's response. Well, let's just do it. So I had David McCabe on earlier this week from Axios, and he had written a piece about how, there could be congressional, we've talked about this, crackdown,
yep.
How Facebook and some of these companies have created their software in a way that increases the possibility of quote-unquote addiction. And that, there may be a reckoning coming. Well, at the time I talked to David, I don't think Apple had made any sort of formal statement or outlined a plan, and it looks like now they have.
Yeah, so it's worth pointing out, two of their largest shareholders put out a letter on Saturday, which you can read on CNET, about how they need to look into this, and they're really concerned about it. The point that really stood out to me is that teenagers who use social media regularly are 27% more likely to be depressed, which is a really scary stat to me.
It's almost accepted, right, that an excessive use of social media leads to unhappiness.
Yes, and it's a pretty common perception, and it seems to be bearing out at least in some cases. And so Apple finally responded, and they said, look, we are actually very actively thinking about this. We plan to have new features coming up soon that's going to deal with the issue of how children use the phone. And, I think that it got them to really at least be public about some of the stuff that they think about. And look, it's incumbent upon Apple to be thoughtful about these things, right? It's just like, I'm not calling an iPhone a cigarette, but it's just like the cigarette companies need to know what is the health damage of their products.
It's so funny.
The car companies need to know how dangerous is a car when it crashes. And the phone makers need to know how dangerous a phone is on our brain.
It's so funny that you bring up cigarettes, because McKay brought that up. He tagged his article by saying, will we see sort of a war on this the way we saw a war on cigarettes. Are those two illnesses or situations comparable?
I don't think it's at all fair to be calling them comparable, right? In one case, you had an industry that actively knew that their product was killing people and covered it up. There's no indications Apple's in that place. And by the way, it's not just Apple.
Well, but wait a minute. But Apple does know, that, or these companies do know, that they're using the habit or the science of habit to create their products, so they must know they're trying to do that.
Yes, but the question is, you know, the question, and the habit part is definitely there, right? The question is, what's the damage? And we don't know. Like, we really don't know what it is. There's anecdotal evidence all over the place. But, you know, part of the problem is that the world is much more interconnected than ever before. You know, Apple's not making Facebook. Right, they have the Facebook app is on the phone, but they aren't making it. They're not making Snapchat. They're not making the games. And yes, it is on them to help police them. But you know, this is part of the problem: is that if you look at the top companies in the world by market value, right, every one of them is now being accused of something in this system, in this issue, and so we have to deal with. You know, those types of questions, because it's more than just Apple and Samsung. It's a fundamental thing about how we interact with the world these days.
That is Ian Schur, a senior editor at CNET at the CES show. Hey, listen, enjoy yourself, and we'll talk again next week.
My pleasure.
Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGNR. Lise Glink is in the studio, publisher of ThinkLink.com. She's the CEO of Best Money Moves. Check that out if you're an employer or even an employee interested in gauging your sort of financial stress level, and then they sort out different ways to ease that stress. She eases my stress every time she's here. Elise, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
All right, so we've talked from time to time about millennials and how they tend not to be home buyers. Now, I think the last time I said that to you, you said, well, they're starting to be home buyers.
Right. It's completely shifted now. We are seeing millennials come in as the largest part of first-time home buyers. They're a little bit over 50% officially. And we're also seeing them be a little over a third of all home buyers.
Is that because there's been a shift in mentality, or it's just the numbers and they're getting to the age where that happens?
You know, it's interesting. I think that we've time shifted. Our society has time shifted certain major milestones, right? So people used to go to college in 4 years. Now sometimes it's 5 or 6 years. They get into the workforce and they've pushed back the age that they get married at and the age they buy their first homes. And now the age they're buying their first homes is about 34. Well, guess what? Millennials are now 34, 35, 36.
Interesting.
And so they're starting to move into that home buying phase.
You know, this is going to be a weird offshoot, but I interviewed Cokie Roberts years ago.
Uh-huh.
And she wrote a book and it was about mothers and daughters.
Yeah, I remember it.
Do you? Okay. But what I took from that book, and I try to remind, and I do use this as advice to people, I try to remind myself that life is long.
it's getting longer.
Well, but we think of things as life is short. You've got to get your degree, then you've got to get your job, you've got to get married, you know, and if you're not on that fast pace, it's as if you're behind somehow. The fact is, life is long. And just when you described how we're sort of stretching these things out, that sort of reminded me of living by that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to not rush through and to not make fast decisions.
Which I'm the worst at. I feel like I need to, but...
Yeah, well, I think we all do, because there's this internal clock that we have, and particularly in radio, where you're always looking at the next commercial break.
It's 5:55, by the way. 12:55.
But I think when it comes to buying a house, you know, we want people to slow down a little bit. And what's happened is an interesting conflict over the last 10 years, where we've seen this huge housing crisis. Property prices fell, and then property prices, like, you know, stock market, have just zoomed up in so many parts of the country. Not quite here in Chicago, but in other places. At the same time, mortgage interest rates are really low, and millennials are now at a place where are established enough in their careers, they've saved money. Now they're starting to get married. Now if they're going to have a kid, they're thinking about a kid. So they're thinking about schools. And all those things that people think about when they buy their first homes are now happening for millennials.
Are they different buyers? Because I was reading an article today said that millennials are less likely to buy a property that needs repair or long-term work in exchange for a lower price. They just kind of want to have everything done.
Oh, it's the HGTV syndrome. I've been talking about it for years. So as we talked off camera about, you know, I've just finished rewriting my best-selling book, 100 Questions Every First-Time Homebuyer Should Ask. It's the fourth edition. It officially comes out about a month from now, but you can pre-order it on Amazon if you want. That book, I first published it in 1994, And here we are in 2018, and the changes, I really had to write a whole new book.
I was
all
ask
for
you
millennials.
That. So the questions have changed or the answers have changed?
A lot of questions have changed. A lot of answers have changed. There's very little that's original to the book, except a few first-time buyer stories that I thought people would enjoy, you know, reading about and learning right. from. But the way millennials think about housing, the way they shop for it, what they're willing to trade off. They're willing to trade off space in a way that, you know, your generation and my generation, we weren't willing to do that. We wanted bigger. And they're like, no, we want smaller. We don't want to own that much. We don't want to be responsible for that much.
Millennials get ripped on, but I think I kind of admired them. That's admirable to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's great to be smart about spending. As you know from my work in Best Money Moves, I'm all about you making your best money move.
All right. What's the name of the book again?
It's called 100 Questions Every First-Time Homebuyer Should Ask, 4th edition. It's the blue cover this time. They totally changed the look of the book, for the blue cover on Amazon.
All right. So thinklink.com would have information on it as well, I would think.
Yep. It has some there. And you can just find me online.
All right. Nice to see you again.
You too.